perhaps there's the despair of like, what's the point if everything, what's the point of composing a symphony if I can just tell prime intellect, like, compose me a symphony? We're seeing that with Chat GPT and OpenAI and Midjourney and Stable Diffusion. Like, people are getting depressed.
Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast with David Nichtern on the Be Here Now Network. My name is Michael Kammers, your host and monologist. And on behalf of all of us at Be Here Now and Dharma Moon, we sincerely hope that this podcast finds you as well as can be, and we are grateful that you are joining us. Here at CSM, our guy David Nichtern discusses how to lead an integrated life involving spiritual practice, creative expression, and right livelihood with guests who embody and manifest these principles in their own life. And in this episode, we are very excited to have artist and comedian Ramin Nazer joining us. Now, Ramin shared a very brief biography with us, so as you are listening to this intro, I encourage you to head over to RaminNazer.com or his Instagram profile and take in the incredible digital art that Ramin makes. I'm personally a big fan. His works are kind of meme-like in that they have a short text on them couched in very compelling psychedelic imagery. Each one is like its own artistic pith instruction. Seeing his work, if you're unfamiliar, will be the best intro for this podcast. So here goes Ramin's bio. Ramin Nazer is an artist based in Los Angeles, California. He's the author of After You Die, Infinite Elephants, and Cafe Paintings for Future People. Ramin has been a featured guest on The Late Late Show on CBS and has appeared on Comedy Central's animated series, Tales from the Trip. You can listen to Ramin interview a variety of different artists, musicians, and comedians on his own podcast, Rainbow Brain Skull. Ramin is currently promoting the Rainbow Brain Skull Oracle Deck, which is a beautiful art object on its own and is designed to help you see the bigger picture, make better decisions, and become more in tune with the flow of life. Now available for purchase at his website, RaminNazer.com. You can also download it as an app. We encourage everyone to follow at Ramin Nazer on Instagram for new comics every day, and check out his Patreon while you're at it. Okay, friends, it would not be an opening monologue of the CSM podcast if we did not mention some of the upcoming program at Dharma Moon. So, we are very excited to announce that we are offering our very first in-person retreat, Windhorse, raising power and energy to meet the challenge of living. Join David and the Dharma Moon community for a special five-day retreat Wednesday, May 1st through Sunday, May 5th, 2024 at Tibet House's Menla Retreat Center in Phoenicia, New York. We will come together in person to learn the transformative Windhorse practices to connect with our unconditional confidence, natural vitality, and each other. Space is limited and this retreat is expected to reach capacity, so be sure to reserve your spot as soon as possible. We always have lots of exciting stuff in the works, and these podcasts are evergreen, so whenever you are listening, we encourage you to head over to dharmamoon.com to check out our programming around mindfulness and Buddhist studies. Okay, friends, that's it for the intro, and now it is our pleasure to share with you episode number 51 of the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast with Ramin Nazer.
Okay, so welcome back, everybody, to the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast, where we try to talk about those kind of things together with some people who are themselves exploring any of those, or any two together, or all three together.
I can give you the first two.
Okay.
Maybe not the second one either.
Well, that's sometimes I say, here's the three things, pick two, because that has a history. But I want to introduce our guest to you all today, which is Ramin Nazer. And I hope I'm saying it exactly.
Hi, right. Thanks for having me. Hey, everyone.
am I saying the name correctly?
Oh, yeah, you nailed it.
Okay, Ramin. So Ramin is a new friend. We've just been chatting for a bit before the podcast. And he's what we would call a multi-dimensional person in terms of what his activity in the world is. He's been a comedian. He's probably widely known as an artist of kind of a unique style of presenting, which I'm going to want to ask him more about. And and a podcaster yourself, right? You're actively engaged in communication that way. So first of all, welcome and thank you for joining our podcast.
Thank you. It's an honor. I've been looking forward to it. I don't know how long we've been trying to put this together, but it's one of those ones where you reschedule every month. Like, no, I'm gone. No, I'm gone. No, I'm not waking up today. No, I'm not waking up today. That's probably more me, but looking forward to this one. And
And then I saw that you were on a podcast with my friend Raghu Marcus from Love, Serve, Remember Foundation.
Love the goo. Who doesn't love the goo?
Love the goo.
I mean, some people don't, I guess, on Reddit, but Reddit people don't like anything.
Isn't that the gig on Reddit is what you don't like?
Yeah, if you show up there, you got to at least hate half of everything just to be there.
Yeah. So because our podcast is on that platform, and you may or may not know, but I'm actively engaging with those folks regularly because I play guitar and produce records for Krishna Das.
Yep.
So I'm with them on retreats in Boone and in Maui and so forth. So
the Satsang.
Satsang, yeah.
Raghu, Sharon Salzberg, Krishna Das, you, the spirit of Ram Das. Spirit of Neem Karoli Baba.
Yeah, that's interesting too. And of course, some of our mutual friends, that's how I met them, is through that. I met Duncan Trussell, who's a mutual friend.
Pete Holmes.
Pete Holmes, who's a mutual friend, who also used to live in that neck of the woods that you're still in.
Steven Tyler.
I think he just stopped by there. Yeah, he has stopped by the retreat. Yeah, there's all kinds of interesting collection of folks. So who do you like to hang out with these days? Are you hanging out with comedians, artists, all kinds of people?
I've been bad about hanging out these last few months. I've become unintentionally insular. I would say like a good mix of half artists, comedians, musicians too. Musicians I've been hanging out with. It's a weird thing in Los Angeles. It's isolating in a way, and you're also connected to everybody, and you have lots of, not everybody, I mean, maybe I'm fortunate, but I have many friends of different interests, and it's difficult to coordinate getting together regularly because you get swept away with this and that, and you make plans and then you can't go to the plans, or you're not feeling well that way, and it's easier to bail on a plan than to just get up, get dressed, go find parking, drive across town.
Right.
That's all my fault. It's not anyone else's fault.
You know, driving used to be easy in LA. Back in the day, it was, you kind of flowed through the town. It was very pleasant. But it's much more challenging, right, to get from A to B there.
Yeah. And just the way that there's so much to do in your own house, I feel like also, let's take it back to pre-internet days. You would probably get bored in your house. Like, no, we should go hang out. Let's go make stuff happen because I've just got this magazine and my own thoughts. So let's go. And then the three channels on TV. But now there's endless everything, and you've got your own projects and you've got your own emails to catch up on. And then when you're weighing it, it's like, should I go hang out or should I catch up on work so that I don't fall behind, so I can but that's my goal of this year, is if I commit to a thing, then it's happening. And I don't mean that I flake on people if I say I'm going to pick them up at the airport. I mean that, if it says, oh, we should hang out next week, that to me counts as like, I'm going to do it. I'm not going to let it float away into, because I find that, I heard this somewhere, but relationships rarely end. Like, it's rarely like, I'm never talking to you again. This is it. It's rare. It's more often that they just kind of disappear over the horizon because you rescheduled for a month, 2 months, a year. And that's
how they wither on the vine.
Yeah, exactly.
They're just not getting enough juice coming through.
And you need it. Yeah. You need to connect with other people, even if you think that lunch will be boring or getting coffee with someone will be boring. It's so important to just actually do that every now and then. And the online is no replacement for it. It's a very cheap facsimile of it. It kind of fools your conscious brain into thinking that you did a social thing, but the rest of your being was not nourished.
Well, and I imagine that your artwork keeps you in house for part, you know, significant part of the time, right? You can't really, that's not really a social activity when you're doing your artwork, right?
No, I mean, it could be. There's live painting and you can get together with people, but honestly, the visual artwork, it is, it's bad in a way because I can do it alone. I can do it from bed and I can listen to something else while I'm doing it. Like I can listen to a podcast or music or anything while I'm doing that stuff. Whereas if you're composing music or you're editing a film, you can't listen to a podcast while you're making music. It's too, it's competing for that focus, but this way I don't have to really focus. I can color while there's music and I'm trying to, and that's why it takes the place of other stuff such as music or podcast editing. Wow. So I ended up doing that more.
And how, you know, I don't know if this is exactly right, but, Midnight Gospel, I know you're aware.
You're episode one, right?
No, I was in episode 4, I believe.
Oh, I remember you as episode
maybe
one.
Maybe six.
Dr. Drew was episode. Maybe you're the first episode I put on, but I don't know. For some reason, I remember like, oh yeah, you were the first episode of that.
But so I know you must know Pendleton Ward, who's the artist in that series, right?
I know of him. I've never met him though. It's we've just never crossed paths because.
Is there anything in your way of looking at it that has any kind of similarity with what at least the it has some flavor that's reminiscent a little bit of the artwork in that series.
Oh yeah, we get compared to each other pretty
you do
frequently. Okay. Yeah, and when that show first came out, some people thought I was involved in it,
okay,
and I had to say no, I was not involved. I knew Duncan. I knew about the show before it was even in the production stages. I knew he was working on something with Pendleton. With old podcast episodes. And then I forgot about it for 2 years. And then when it came out, I was like, this is so cool. And it came out at the perfect time.
It is so cool. And believe it or not, or, you know, maybe it's not that strange. My little appearance as a cartoon character in that series has had major ripple effect in terms of people coming and studying Buddhism.
Nice.
And Dharma. And our we have at Dharma Moon, we have a teacher training program. And you know, quite a few Duncan recirculating energy through his community and ours.
Yeah, he's brought. I mean, him and maybe Pete Holmes too. I don't know who has the bigger effect on the metrics, but I just imagine like so many people find you, Ram Dass, that whole Be Here Now satsang-ness thanks to him and. Then you can trace that also to how many people wouldn't know about Duncan if it wasn't for Joe Rogan podcast. How many people wouldn't know about any of that if it wasn't for podcasts, if it was just the 4 late night talk shows. So the thing is just what you need to hear, it's so much easier to find.
Well, and are you a techie at all? Are you interested in tech?
Yeah, I am. I would say I'm a techie. And that word has, because tech has accelerated faster than anything, you can have a lot of knowledge and still know nothing. Like, for example, I'm not great with blockchain, NFTs, crypto. That's not really my interest. I'm an okay, like 2D game programmer and web developer and that kind of stuff. And I follow Singularity and Futurology.
Today... the day of our conversation, it won't be the same as the day that folks are seeing this. You probably saw that Neuralink, you know, Elon Musk company, they implanted their first chip in somebody's brain. Did you know that?
A human? No, I didn't.
Yeah, that was in the news today that the first guinea pig or what have you, they implanted the first Neuralink chimp went.
Oh, no, Link. You got to edit that out.
Sorry. Link went right into. A human being's brain today.
Everything okay with them? What if they just stop it there? It's like, we implanted our first chip. How are they? Can we speak to them? No.
Well, they aren't telling a lot about it, but they're saying basically the person is okay, and they're not really revealing a lot about it. But the impetus of it is that you'd be able to interface directly from the brain to the computer. So somebody like Stephen Hawking, for example, could just output his thoughts and you'd see them on the screen, bypassing the voice, bypassing the fingers, direct brain to world. You know?
Yeah, it's nuts. And as with any development like that, you know, you can get nuclear power plant and you can have the nuclear bomb. It's always the range of things from it. So the positive is you bring up, you know, Stephen Hawking, people with disabilities can now interface with their body, with the world better. They're not like trapped anymore. And then the downside is like, it's our phones on crack, on crack, on crack, on crack. Like imagine if you truly were always jacked on, if you were always, you know, getting Pepsi ads in your dreams and all that kind of stuff. But I think this is just not to go too much on a tangent here, but I think this is destiny in a way. Like we left the ocean, we make societies, we develop agriculture, we build the internet, and it's all kind of veering towards us having a collective mind while retaining our individuality. But it's the whole single-celled organism to multi-celled organism story once again, this time with technologies.
Yeah, I mean, what are you going to do to be out of sequence with the actual events in your world and your life? You can't really just drop out. Although my generation certainly tried, were famous for it, you know. And then you see like somebody like Ram Dass who dropped out and then ended up in India and becoming a bridge for something that needed to happen at that time and the place anyhow. So you're always dropping out and back in, but. I wonder sometimes if you're in a middle generation, and I work a lot with even younger folk, and I think there's something in the basic language, the basic communication protocols, the way people are connecting, that is really changing pretty dramatically.
Yeah, and for all the complaints about the excessive morality or social justice warrior stuff, like the empathy. You could see that the positive of it is like amped up empathy for everyone. Whereas before it would be like, oh, those Russians across the border, those Chinese, like now it's, we don't see the most people, I think, hopefully, or in general, we don't see people in other countries as the other. We recognize that, oh, they're citizens, they've got their culture, and they probably don't like what the government there is doing either, the same way we don't like what our government is doing. So we can't just put the blame on. It's harder to go to war and have the support of people, I think.
Yeah, the duality is sort of mushing lava lamp, melting in together and weird. And sometimes what I can get from what you're saying, you're basically an optimist, are you not?
I don't default to it, but I subscribe to it. I'm always trying to get philosophical with everything and finding the route of like why this is good. How can we get out of this? Even if it's a photo finish, it might be trending downwards, but then the last second, like, oh, we turned it around. Whether it was through, I don't think we're gonna turn this enterprise around through everyone doing a little better, like, okay, if you could just pick up one more can, if everyone could just turn their lights off like an hour before bed. I don't think we're doing any of that, but I think there's going to be paradigm shifts that turn it around. And this is coming from someone with no understanding of climate change or carbon emission level things, but just the general feeling of that, of like, no, we can get out of this, even if it seems like we won't.
So, you know, when you connect with people who are going to have to live through all this, it seems like that's one part is it's going to be challenging, but it's going to work through. And the other is, I remember a young man who took a course that I was teaching up at Kripalu Institute. And then I had a long conversation with about the dystopia. He was very sensitive to the dystopic element of what's been evolving. And then I heard he committed suicide the next year, you know, so it was heartbreaking because he was very bright and, you know, who knows, there's other factors involved always, of course, these things. But one of it was he was just looking down the barrel of a evolving situation and going, no.
Yeah.
Can't make it. Can't abide there. So, but you seem to have a seed a radioactive seed of goodness in you that's very positive. That's what I get anyhow.
Is that fair? Thank you. Yeah, yeah. And at least I want to see what happens. I can't I can't argue it from a rational standpoint. Like, I'm sure there's people that could bring me mountains of evidence as to why the future is bad. And I'm like, no, I'm still going to put my chips on future is good. I love sci-fi. I love the rare genre of utopian sci-fi where there's still problems, because so much sci-fi is about AI takes over and then we're stuck in scarcity. It's even more scarcity than now. And it's it's really rough. And there's sci-fi like, you know, Accelerando or Metamorphosis of Prime Intellect, where there's a benevolent AI that solves all our problems and we're immortal. And then we have to deal with that. And then what do you do?
What's an example of that sci-fi?
That one's the one in particular, Metamorphosis of Prime Intellect, is where this AI is programmed with the three laws of Isaac Asimov robotics, which is you cannot harm any human. You cannot let any human come to harm through inaction. So like if there's an opportunity to save them, you have to save them. And then the third law is you cannot harm yourself. So that means it stays alive forever and all humans stay alive forever. It figures out all the diseases, cancer stuff, and then it fixes it overnight.
Wasn't that the premise of that Will Smith science fiction movie?
The AI one?
Yeah, that what you just said had the three laws of robotics.
Yeah, that's where they're getting it from. So it's like an expansion on that. It's like it lives in a world where Asimov was a writer and this. So like, what if you actually did build that? And so basically, long story short, overnight, once this thing gets turned on and the military decides that, oh, this has no purpose because it can't kill anyone, so we're going to stop funding this thing because it can't be used for our purposes. And then the AI realizes that, oh no, I'm going to be shut down. I'm going to die. I have to save myself. And it starts thinking of like, oh, you know that quantum teleportation principle you guys figured out that you can do at the microscopic level? There's no mathematical reason why that's limited to the microscopic level. I could figure that out at scale. Give me 1 minute. And then it does for 15 minutes. It figures out how to teleport itself. It moves out of the basement. It goes to hospitals. It starts scanning people. It starts saving the whole world. And then this day is known as the change. So after the change, no one can die. And then the whole book is...
This is an Asimov book?
No. It's I forget who wrote it, but it's kind of a short story too. It's not even a long novel, but it just explores the idea that you can still have problems in a post-scarcity world where all your desires are fulfilled instantly. Like, what would that look like if everything you desired was fulfilled right now and you're alive forever? Like, you're still stuck with yourself. Like, you're not, it's the Buddha story in a way, in that he had everything. He was the rich prince and then wasn't happy. And then, so then there's people
it's really in the Buddhist framework, it would be the God realm, Devaloka. There are six realms. And one of them is, I wrote a book about this called Awakening from the Daydream. And it's a reframing of that teaching. But the God realms, which is where most people think is the target for spiritual development and materialistic development, leads to a very seemingly eternal, blissful situation, but it's still governed by impermanence.
Yeah.
So therefore, the rug is still going to be pulled at a certain point in time, even if it's eons from now. And a lot of people would say, yeah, that bliss would be the target for spiritual practice. You want to achieve a blissful state. But it's not sustainable. That's why it's part of the samsaric situation, the confused situation. It's not really sustainable. So,
yeah.
A lot of when you talk about the story you're talking about, the idea that now it's permanent actually becomes claustrophobic, is what you're saying.
Yeah. But before, we didn't really know that we were relying on that. But yeah, if you are alive forever with your own thoughts, experiences, and I don't know, you keep getting in your own way. Or perhaps there's the despair of like, what's the point if everything, what's the point of composing a symphony if I can just tell Prime Intellect, like, compose me a symphony? We're seeing that with ChatGPT and OpenAI and Midjourney and stable diffusion. Like people are getting depressed at, I mean, there's the anger too. It's like, oh, it's stealing artists' work and it's stealing our soul. And then there's the anger of, yeah, well, what am I supposed to do now? Even if I had universal basic income, what is my purpose now that it can
well, and that's why that eternalism has the seed of nihilism in it, which is the hell realm. You know, you go like, there's no point to any of this. And they say in the traditional scriptures, you know, that when a being who's achieved that level of kind of bliss and, you know, when they get a hint of that they've already created the seed of their own demise in it, they crash and they go right to hell. They don't go through the human realms or the animal realms. They just go right to like, this is a dystopia, a nightmare. And I think that's what that young man was seeing, is that what people are trying to put together as a utopia becomes a dystopia, and the God realm becomes the seed of the hell realm. And so according to Buddhism, anyhow, the solution is you maintain your status as a human being who has ups and downs and who has, you know, longings and disappointments. And yet there's a seed of real depth of wisdom and understanding and compassion in it.
Yeah.
So you bypass the God realms. It's a hard sell, actually.
Yeah. Straight shot to it. Do you feel like it's always a trade-off? Like every era, it's interesting to look back that, you know, before we went to Blockbuster to rent our movies, and then Netflix comes along and mails it to our house, and then that's over. Like it doesn't mail discs anymore. Now you just stream it instantly, and now there's 100 streaming platforms. So anything you like, so much content is available. But now we're looking like, those were good days though. That was a good day when we had to go there, or when we played records. Like
records, vinyl records, you know,
we used
and
to
going
look
to
at
the
it.
Store. And yeah, I'm not nostalgic. It's a weird thing. I don't think of that as a big part of my personal makeup. I'm interested in just staying up with what's going on and having the conversation that's relevant to the current situation. But if I were gonna, as you just led me to it, I was thinking of Tower Records in LA, which maybe when you were a kid, was it still there?
I didn't live in LA at the time, but we had a Tower Records when I lived in Austin, and I did frequent it. And it was right towards the end. This is early 2000s. It was you could see it and smell it in the air, like Napster.
You
was
smell it. That's what I thought. Is smell is one of these primitive senses that you just remember what the smell was like, and.
Yeah.
And so then you would take it home, you know, and maybe smoke a joint or whatever and put on a new record from Cream or whoever, you know, or Jimi Hendrix or whatever was happening at the time. And there was a definite erotic or physical quality. But I don't miss that. Like, for example, somebody just turned me on to a cool Canadian artist the other day. And it was like, boom, it's on my phone. I'm checking it out.
Celine Dion?
No. Hey, boomer. Yeah. You know, in other words, I like the idea that you can suddenly be introduced to a whole zone of interest and activity. And I think I was put on Earth a little bit to be part of the transition into that.
Oh, that's good. So you're not even a little bit like, because when you say nostalgic, people interpret it as, oh, well, you're, you know, in despair about it. But can't you be both? Can't you appreciate the now and also be like, that was a good era. I don't want everyone to be smoking cigarettes on planes now, but that was a cool era. We were wearing suits and we spoke to each other and there was no GPS. Like you just knew how to get somewhere. Like it was a fun era. I miss every era, but I'm also back to the optimism. I'm looking forward to how we tear this one up too.
Well said and point taken. And, you know, if one were kind of like, you know, it seems that you have a kind of Libra mind, you know, like you're balancing things off as you go. It's a beautiful quality and I already barely know you and I appreciate it a lot. So it's, you know, yes, you can appreciate it, the past, and you can also be very current at the same time.
Yeah.
That's a healthy balance. And I also do think certain things as how they were, like, for example, I teach a lot of Buddhism, as you know, there's the doctrine, you know, and passing along ideas, and there's the transmission element of it. And I would say the transmission has weakened, because it used to be you would study with a particular teacher for a considerable period of time. There was significant physical, you're in the same place at the same time, and you're watching how somebody actually handles a cup of tea or a conversation. And also then there are literal direct transmissions of teachings that are not the textual or doctrinal part of it, but the feeling and essence of it. And I think that's weakened. Personally, if I had to talk about teaching these days, maybe people are not getting that much transmission. They're getting more of the doctrine, and then they're doing a do-it-yourself kit with that.
Are you saying because it's accessible online, or are you saying even in person it's weakened?
Because it, as you said, there is things that, like that vinyl thing, you know, when you went to the record store, there's actually going someplace. There's actually offering, an offering or a gift. There's actually putting yourself in the position of being a student and kind of being humble and being, invoking and supplicating, that those things are not valued in the current culture, because people are very suspicious, rightly so, in many, many cases, that they're being hoodwinked.
Yeah.
But the thing of Buddha, the basic Buddha thing is, don't be hoodwinked. There's one thing Buddha said, it's don't be, even by me, he's saying it.
That's a good point.
My teachers all said that. Don't buy any wooden nickels, you know, here. Chew it on yourself. So, but, you know, fear of being hoodwinked shouldn't generate your relationship to the ancestry that you have, you know?
No, and you've got to also have the paradox with it. It has to be the open-minded skepticism thing. Don't close off your mind and close off your heart, but also like, and I'm not saying have a knife behind your back either in that sense, but just kind of embrace that in taking that risk that comes with the territory. It's a risk to open up. You could be hoodwinked, but to close yourself off forever, you're hoodwinking yourself, because then you're not leaving the grounds. So the ships are not safe at sea, but that is not what ships were. Oh no, the ship is safest in the harbor, but that is not what ships were built for. That's the whole thing.
Well, you know, people talk these days about safe zones, growth zones, and risk zones. That's something that Dharma, when we talk about those. So when somebody says, I just want to be safe, it's just the parable that you just rendered there is a perfect example. Well, you want to stay in the harbor, so you're not going to go out into the growth zone.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, you know, you put yourself at risk in certain situations. And in the Buddhist tradition, there are higher and higher levels of risk. You could say risk-reward ratio almost, you know. But the ground of it is some kind of safety of like, you know, like if you took the metta practice, you know, the loving kindness practice, may you be safe. It says it right in there. May you be happy. May you be healthy. So the ground is that you don't feel like you're on, you know, okay, you're sitting on ice and it's melting and you're going to end up, you know, drowning. You get a nice comfortable seat in a cottage or a house, and you have a cushion and you have a ground, but your mind is still always in the risk zone.
Yeah.
By its own nature.
Yeah. That's how we got here as through evolution, is because when you hear a rustle in the bushes, you know, sometimes I'm wondering, like, when I'm about to say something, I'm like, oh crap, did I already hear you say that? Am I just saying your quote back to you from two podcasts ago? But basically the anxiety neurosis is what kept us alive for a million years, because the ancestors that were neurotic were the ones that survived, and the ones that were like, oh, let's just go see what the sound is without being careful about it, that line didn't reproduce.
Yeah, and there's at the physical level, it's obvious, easy to track. We're in danger, by being alive.
Yep.
At risk by being alive. You get born, then you're going through a bunch of harrowing experiences, and after this, with short respites of feeling like, okay, I'm cool now. We were talking about puberty before we came on. You know, God, what a risk zone that is. You just, like, your whole body changing, your whole energy changing. What about graduating from college and realizing, like, when my son graduated from college, and when I graduated from college, my father said, nice to know you, basically. I don't mean, you know, emotionally, but like, how about you're entering the risk, the growth zone now, and you got to take care of yourself. So, yeah. So, coming back to that, you're clearly somebody who's a creative. Would you say that your job is to create stuff?
Oh yeah, 100%. And okay. I don't say that in any type of important way. I think, you know, the creativity is, and everybody can tap into it. But I would say that is of the three things: creativity, spirituality, and making a buck. I would feel like most of my chips are in the creative, and then I could do a little better with the spiritual and the making a buck part.
Okay, which is what this book is all about, just so you know, because I hear that from a variety of people. I myself am an artist. I'm a musician, obviously, a composer, guitar player.
So Berkeley I had College of Music.
Yes. And from then on into the wild world of television, film, records, you know, and, you know, trying to put it together as a livelihood and study, you know, Buddhism at the same time, which is saying, hey, some of the Buddhists say, just don't get involved with that stuff. That's just the red dust world. It's just, you know, you become a renunciate like Buddha did or like the monks do. So how to integrate that? So when you say you're a creative and you could use tuning in your spiritual practice and your livelihood dimension, I get to be like, this is just who I am, all ears, and I want to hear all about it.
About which part, the creativity part or about the wanting to tune in?
The crossing over, because it's clear that, or maybe it's not clear, that your relationship to your creativity is pretty healthy.
I would say so.
You know, let it flow, you let it come.
I feel like in a way I've always been like that. I was I wasn't a delinquent. I wasn't failing out of school, but in a family with, you know, they've got PhDs, my brother's a professor, always honor student, cousins, all that. Like my family is very academic and they perform well in school. And I found myself to be more of a black sheep in that way. And I was more of the doodler. I wanted to play instruments. I didn't have a plan of like how this would make money, but that stuff just always was so much more important to me. And those were my heroes. Like musicians were my heroes, artists were my heroes. I just looked up to that so much more, and I always felt better when I was engaging in that stuff as opposed to.
And you fearlessly jumped into it. You allowed yourself to not be dominated by this other gestalt of like, hey, you got to do this and you got to be linear and you got to be conventional and you got to make X amount of dollars a year. You just went, I'm drawing right now, everybody, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I tried the other way. I just freeze up. And even in the, like, let's take, I think about in the realm of stand-up comedy, like when I was most in it, I was given the opportunity to submit a packet for SNL, you know, Saturday Night Live. And I'm like, oh, this could be great. Like I could be on SNL. I could become a writer for it, or I could be a featured player or a cast. And then I'm like looking at the writer's packet and it just looked like homework to me, the having to write a celebrity sketch, a current events sketch. This, like, it's very specific. And there's people that can do both. There's people that can do their own voice and they're good at writing for that. But for me, I couldn't do a single part of it. I just stared at it every day. I'm like, what's wrong with you? This is supposed to be your dream. So even stuff within what you thought was your dream, sometimes you can't even conform to that.
It was this too straight in a way for.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
It didn't have enough curved space in it, you know?
Yeah, and I always liked originals too. Like, you know, Jimi Hendrix, original. Joni Mitchell, original. Just on and on. Like people that are in their own lane 100% and you know that they brought to the world something the world never even asked for. The world wasn't like, oh, it'd be great if we had some Jimi Hendrix right now. It was just like the world is one way, and then the next day a new color is introduced, like, oh, I didn't even know I needed that, and there it is, and people tapping into that.
I call that
of themselves.
I call that Ramin Nasir the first. you know, but you do have a house. You're in LA, right?
Yeah.
We won't say where you live in case there's any, like, you know, people who would want to find you for
nefarious
purposes.
I have the high ground.
Okay.
You have to get up a lot of stairs. But also, I don't think your listeners are maniacs. Maybe a couple.
Oh gosh. There's every variation known. But we have gathered a really nice gathering of satsang, as you called it, in general. But you have to pay your rent on that house, or do you own the house?
I have to pay rent on this house.
Okay. So How does that happen?
How does that happen? I sell books, I sell shirts, I sell Oracle deck. Oh, I've got some here. This is my Oracle deck, the Rainbow Brain Skull Oracle deck.
Rainbow Brain Skull Oracle deck.
I've got compilations of my drawings in various books. I have, I believe, 10 books right now. I never set out to be a publisher of many books. I was just kind of doing my thing, and then a book emerged from it. And then over time, people are asking, like, oh, can you sell prints? Can you sell shirts? Right. Can you sell this? Can you sell stickers? And I added stuff based on demand. And then a decade or so later, I'm like looking at this, wow, I've got this little pirate ship of stuff that I'm selling. And I occasionally do commission work. So I draw stuff for other people for like a music festival, or do an animation for Litter Robot, or a musician putting out a record, or a podcast cover, just stuff like that. Eventually, I was doing less and less of, and then doing more of my own, running my little business of the various items I just talked about. But yeah, I haven't had a real honest job in over a decade. And
whoa. Okay, see, I'm going to interrupt there. That is an honest job.
It is, but it's one of those things of, you know what I mean. Like, I don't have a boss. I don't have an alarm clock. I don't show up to a building every day. I don't have cake on Sandy's birthday and discuss the latest gossip at the water cooler. It's just me.
But how you approach generating your livelihood and your revenue from that has, you know, a wide range of possibilities.
That's true. I will say I'm a professional. You know that Stephen Pressfield book of the professional shows up every day. Mm-hmm. And the reason, if you're a professional accountant versus a professional guitar player, is because you're showing up to the accounting job every day. Mm-hmm. Even if you don't like it, you are a professional. You wake up and you go to it, because if you don't, then you're going to be fired. And you have to treat your independent art job that way too. I have to show up every single day, even if I don't feel like it. Otherwise, I'm fired.
And you're also wearing the invisible armor of an entrepreneur, in that, you know, you're showing up for how do you create revenue from your creativity. And there's a wide range there. And it's like, some people have gotten very wealthy doing things like that.
Oh, yeah, they have.
Yeah,
there's both. There's
a full spectrum, don't you think?
There's 100% the full spectrum and the inverse of it. So I think that there's people who are not technically skilled that have made millions on their work. There's people who are very technically skilled and they live on the street. There's people, you know, that they can draw your face in 3 seconds, but they just live on a street corner. Like, oh, that guy's really talented. I don't know why this guy lives on the street. Mm-hmm. And there's both. There's people who are very technically talented and make money. And then there's, of course, the obvious one is the people with the no talent and the no money. That's a lot of people can fit into that. Like, oh, that's a bunk deal. But it's important to remember that they can have nothing to do with each other.
That could be a great yogi there.
Yeah, he's just got to rebrand. It's
no talent, no money, but great wisdom or something, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, but so it's interesting, you know, for me personally, I just like this part of the thing where enough to have written a book about it and started a podcast to have the conversation. And I do counsel people one-to-one quite a lot of where, okay, we just want to build up this area a little bit, because it's a different toolbox. You know, that like to sell your books is a different toolbox than creating them. They're interdependent, but you know, and sometimes people just haven't had that training in that aspect. And it's not a big job to you know, find out where, you know, just like you know how to craft a piece of work, crafting distribution or crafting marketing is not that different from it, but it is distinct in a way.
Yeah, it's a different type of fear you have to face, but it all just boils down to fear. But let's say you're the fear of the vulnerability of sharing a work, whether it's a song or a visual thing that's from a deep, vulnerable place, like that involves confronting fear. And then there's the fear of selling, which then your fear is the world is going to think that I'm trying to make a buck, which I am. I'm not only trying to make a buck, but of course I'm not selling it at cost.
Right. Here,
it's arbitrage. At the end of the day, I'm selling paper that the paper does not have as much value as when you put the ink on the paper, and the ink on the paper, like when you're boiling it down to its component parts, it's like, hey, you're selling it for more than cost. Like, yeah, that's the grift, because I have to make the money so that I can pay the rent, which is also a grift, because the mortgage of the guy that owns the building is less than or equal to the, so it's all you have to sell it for more than the cost. But it should be happy on both sides. Like, I do that too. I buy stuff from people and I'm aware that it's selling it at higher than cost, but I'm happy at the end of the day. And that should be the goal, is you want people that buy stuff from you to be happy with it, and you should be happy with the amount they're paying. It shouldn't be like, I didn't make enough, so I'm resenting this person for buying it this cheap, and they shouldn't be resenting you for paying too much.
And you know, when you think about it, you do feel that way if you go to a restaurant, get a good meal, or if you buy a sweater or a pair of shoes. You feel like some kind of honest exchange has happened that shouldn't be embarrassing for either party. But the fear is interesting. So the fear, I think you identified two kinds of fear there in what you said. One is, am I good enough? What I would call imposter syndrome or poverty mentality, right? And then the other would be, you know, just what do other people think?
Yeah. Especially when the world gets chaotic. The world is always chaotic, but if you just work at a job, world events don't affect you as much to showing up the job. But let's say you're promoting a new book and it's on the day or the week of a new global catastrophe. Like that sucks. It's like, oh, I'll wait for 1 week until we've habituated to it and then announce it. Or I just dive in and be like, hey, my book just dropped today, even though there's bombs going off in the background and people are all sharing flags of certain natures. It's like, oh, what do you do? And I've kind of, I'm the more lean into it type of thing, like even if there's criticism, but I don't sell as much as I could. I feel like I leave a lot of money on the table. I don't advertise and promote as much as I should because of the fear, but because I don't get complaints about it. If I was doing it enough, I would get some people saying like, all right, enough already with the trying to sell stuff. But I've avoided that so heavily that I get no criticism. And thus I wait too long. I don't accumulate wealth. I make enough and then I chill for months, and then it's like, oh no, I checked the bank account. I should probably be making some money right now if I want to continue to pay for all this. So I don't hoard. I make enough and then I wait too long, and then I scramble.
You know, first thought, best thought, when you, I'm thinking, you know, I have a Tai Chi teacher named Sat Han here in New York, and he's, you know, he's kind of quite deeply studied in classical Chinese arts and application of contemporary life, and really kind of a major, wonderful teacher for me. And asked him, you know, about vegetarianism, and he said, you should look at the teeth that you have, and that should be the balance of food groups that you eat. So you have the incisors, which is for tearing meat, you know, and you have the molars, which is for grinding grains and so forth. Mm. And to look at your natural makeup as a way for creating the balance that you're talking about, you know. And so I use the body in my book as a way of talking about the different elements of being in a business, which you are. You're an artist, but you're also in the business of being an artist. And that the notion of balancing creativity with sales and marketing, you know, in a healthy way. And marketing is just letting people know that, you know, for example, I'm going to say, we're going to post your website up on this podcast, and we're going to say, let's go check this cool guy's stuff out. And it's cool stuff. And I know people are going to look at it and go, that's cool. And then they're going to go, your website is set up to buy things. I saw that already.
Oh, and yeah.
Who needs to be embarrassed about nothing there? You know what I mean? It's like, that's a healthy kind of thing. But then, you know, backing, I think what I'm feeling is, who cares what other people think on a certain level? That's a, there's a certain amount of health in letting that go.
Yeah, there definitely is. And you know, everything with balance, like you don't want to scare everyone off and just be completely your unhinged reptile brain self. But you don't want to present, you don't want to fool people either. Like, you don't want to present yourself as a wonderful person with no flaws. There's this Patrice O'Neill bit. It's funny where he talks about your first thought or your first feeling is your real feeling. Your second feeling is you trying to fool God into thinking you're a wonderful person. Like, you just override it and bury it up. It's like, no, that first feeling is still part of you. You got to address it and be there with it.
Yeah. My teacher used to say first thought, best thought. And it's the same exact iteration. First thought, best thought. And, you know, we would do poetry slams with Allen Ginsberg, you know, and first thought, cool. best thought, you know, like what, you know, and your creativity clearly has first thought energy to it, right? Your artwork,
yeah.
A lot of first thought energy there, right?
Not to get pretentious about it, but I would even say it's like, it's pre-thought, like you want to get it as somewhere before your brain can, and that's the type of comedy I like too. It's the type that you laugh at before your brain can start putting the things together, because some of the worst comedy is when it's clever and in your head you're like, oh, I see what you did there, and then maybe you give a courtesy laugh, but that's not what you want. You want it to come from the deep soul of someone, like almost to where you close your mouth if you didn't think you're allowed to laugh at that. Not being mean to groups of people, but you know, just know it's like, oh, I didn't, that came out of nowhere, I didn't see that coming.
Well, and we have a practice called Suddenly Free from Fixed Mind. And a training.
I like that title.
Workshop, but that is a sort of way of getting at the pre-thought level, because when you let go of a train of thought, there is a gap before the next one comes in, and that's pre-thought. It's between thoughts. And the interesting thing about that part of the mind, most people don't pay attention to that part of the experience, but it is the most natural aspect of the mind, and it's also quite vivid and aware without having to contextualize something. So, you know, there's been a plane flying across the sky here. I'm looking at the East River from where I'm sitting, and it's the first time I noticed there's a flight path there, and there's been like 10 planes since I noticed it. And then there's a gap of not noticing it, and then I just see the sky, you know?
Yeah.
So there's space, highlights, you know, and creative people, we're helping people to get back to the kind of raw space of just suddenly free from fixed mind and the joy that brings together for people. And then when you move into a more intentional thing of like, okay, setting up your website, things like that, for sometimes for creative people, that part's a drag.
Yeah, not even setting up the website, having to post it places, having to do customer service emails, and so much of what you have to do in any career, you feel like you're escaping it when you leave your 9-to-5 job and you wind up right back where you started. Like, oh, the stuff that is required to run a business is always there. And I know it can be solved through delegation, but I think that's another block.
Not completely.
Yeah, I guess not, because you're still communicating with the delegator. There's no disconnecting.
The person you delegate to could, like, you know, I could tell you a million stories from the music business of like, oh boy, that was a mistake.
Oh, they scammed people in the music industry?
Yeah. One of the first things somebody told me when I was getting into being like a professional songwriter is music business is two words.
Oh, that's good.
That was a good piece of advice. And, you know, I also know that some people, I quote Charles Ives, excuse me, in my book as a composer, great classical composer, 20th century early. And he was an insurance salesman because he did not want that pressure on his creative work. He wanted to just write what he wanted to write.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so that's a model that's cool. But if you are in the game, so to speak, and you're doing it, how can you do it in a way that doesn't betray you? You know, that doesn't betray your intention and your heart. And I've seen people get really pulled off that subtly, and they start it's reading the reviews, you know, that does it.
Yeah.
And don't read the reviews.
And the potential for divinity is so high too, because we just worship musicians because it taps into a deep part of us. But I feel like of all of the things, like, you know, authors, comedians, movie stars, visual artists, musicians, I feel like that's the one that we let get away with the most stuff. Like when you feel like a musician had a scandal or something, you know, Chris Brown or Michael Jackson or just anything, it's like, yeah, but still, we hold them in a different place.
It's true, and that is a trap. People begin to, and you see some great musicians who are very humble still and modest and honest that way. But boy, you know, the Buddha, before he got enlightened, they was seduced by what's called Mara, the daughters of Mara. And they're just going, look, there's all kinds of alternatives for you, baby. You know, you could be rich, you could be famous. Well, let's just slow this train down here towards like complete authenticity and wakeful behavior. You could have X, Y, Z. And he had to kind of like snap out of it, you know?
Yeah.
So that means it became a renunciate path. But I think that's a mistake in the big picture. It doesn't mean it has to be a renunciate path. And there's a lot of instances of Buddha teaching non-renunciate practitioners in a worldly way to just not to be in that stuff, but not necessarily caught up in it. But it's very tricky, right?
Oh, yeah. It's the trickiest, and it never ends, as we see with, you know, musicians that have taken their own lives or ones that are just still, you know, bent on attached to substances because they have to maintain the high of their most worshipped moment.
Oof.
Yeah.
Ouch.
I don't know. I had some other thought with it, but it's gone. But that's good. Yeah. That's good if a thought is gone. Oh, I did want to ask when you were mentioning the gap between thoughts, do you think there is a Planck length, a minimum distance gap, or is the division between gaps infinite? There's like no,
end. What a great question. There's a whole study in the Buddhist literature called Abhidharma, which is the patternings of the way the mind takes shape. It's very detailed. And could be quite scholarly, but it's also revealing. So that they say that it's 128th of a second.
That's how little it gets.
A frame of mind.
Because of is the limitation the speed of light, do you think? Because that's how...
I don't know if it's even literal. And like you could say it's instantaneous too. That would be... there's something they call the fourth moment. Because there's the past, the present, the future. And a lot of the spiritual people say the present, the present, the present. But actually, when you look for the present, you can't find it. It was already gone. So sometimes that teaching is like, it's already gone.
Oh, I like that.
And that's called the fourth moment. Yeah, the fifth beetle is the fourth moment.
That's cool.
Yeah. And so that allows you to not fixate on the present even as a thing.
Yeah.
And I would say that kind of mind is instantaneous in some sense from our sense of time.
What was it? 100th of a 28th of a second.
That analogy is being used to describe mental events.
Yeah.
You know, like the analogy would be like video or film. It's like 24 frames a second and you see it as continuous.
Right, but right.
What we're saying is that it's not actually continuous. It's boop, 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 and you're streaming it together. It's streaming. So it's basically digital. Mind is digital from the point of view of the event horizon of the mind. It's digital. It's not analog. It's not continuous. That's why you can interrupt it with, you know, meditation practice or just a kind of awareness practice. you just go, hey, I just broke the flow and I was thinking about my grandmother and now I'm thinking about, you know, my trip to Hawaii and what happened in between. I wasn't really paying attention to what happened in between.
Yeah.
So we begin to pay attention to that quality of space and awareness that's not formatted, unconditional awareness. And you can notice it. It's something you can notice.
And I remember Ram Dass had some rap about we're pursuing pleasure. You're trying to get those gaps shorter and shorter in between each other so that the moments of pleasure are touching because, you know, heaven forbid there be a space in between the pleasure moments.
Yeah, that's pretty. Yeah, and that's, I think, saying the same thing in a way, but it could be pain also. It's just something definitive. You go, I know where I am. I know who I am. I have an identity. I have a location. I have a moment in time and space where I am who I am. And there's a certain sort of false bottom security to that, that we are pretty well addicted to in this particular way of being. But if you begin to permeate that, you do open up to some kind of uncertainty. And that can have its own form of attraction.
With that attraction to uncertainty?
Yeah.
How so?
Well, why do you think people are taking, you know, psychedelics, for example?
Oh, that's true. Yeah, you want the monotony to melt.
You want some kind of, wow, did you see that frog just jump out of my, you know, of my underpants, you know? No, because it's in your mind. That's why nobody else saw it.
Yeah.
So uncertainty is you're not even sure what's actually happening or who you are.
I remember a friend of mine was going through a really difficult breakup and read this book. I don't remember the name of the book, but it gave him this epiphany of basically when it feels like the floor is falling from underneath you and everything is chaotic, that's true reality. The other one where you had certainty and routine and repetition and certainty, that's the illusion. So when you're in that places falling, like, kind of get used to it. It's like, no, it's okay. This is the nature of actual reality. The other one is an illusion. You will be back in that illusion. You will feel comfort again, but learn to be comfortable with the floor falling realm.
Yeah, the any of it can be solidified into a kind of wishful thinking because it gives you ground. But what you're saying essentially, as I understand it, is that the fundamental situation is groundless.
Yes.
And yet we're not completely comfortable with that at this point in our, you know, manifestation. So we create ground out of relationships. We create ground out of identity. We create ground out of, narrative.
Yeah.
Right. But the ground that's not the real ground. And the real ground is unconditional. And to experience that is actually has its own form of come home to mama energy.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like you and people do take psychedelics to break through to that unconditional quality of their experience. No?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Have you taken psychedelics?
Today, no. But in general.
Now, right before you said that was the gap.
Was there? Oh, yeah. That was the gap.
It was fast because
I have taken psychedelics, but I'm I don't talk about them a whole lot. And it's not out of not liking them or not thinking they're helpful. I think just I'm aware of also it can become a crutch or who knows what your state is when you take them. So I don't prescribe it as a cure-all. I don't think we should spray the air with it and everyone trip all of a sudden. Another Ram Dassism from before, I think him and Tim Leary both were talking about how if we could dose everyone, then we're optimistically less than 10 years away from total human enlightenment. And then, of course, the 70s, 80s happens and okay.
It totally disproved that.
Yeah.
That's been vetted.
But they're good though. I like them. I think it's good to do once a year or once every 6 months. It's a good reset if you're in the right space for it. But
it's how much disruption we allow into our, you know, into our world and then not look at it as destruction, but disruption for a creative end, you know, of liberating, opening up possibilities, you know, how much you trust yourself, how much you trust the world you live in to come together again in a way that's not like a nightmare or a dystopia.
Yeah.
You know, how much letting go we could actually do. And of course, it's related to dying.
Yeah, you do die. The version of you before you took it is dead afterwards.
And literally, you know, the death is the thing that people are horrified about, you know, terrified of.
Yeah, because that's our main, our biological isness as it is. Everything revolves around not die. I mean, it's reproduce and not die. That's like every drive in us is like, don't die, reproduce, don't die, reproduce. Like, okay, but I got to override that a little bit for long term. It's like, okay, we'll override it for this long, but just avoid pleasure seeking.
I have already reproduced, I mean, and as far as I can tell, when I die, my son won't necessarily die.
Oh, yeah.
But
I will die.
So I think reproducing is not the answer, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
It doesn't solve that particular problem.
Oh, but I mean, the drive is in there. Of course, it doesn't solve the problem, but that's what our bodies think.
You think it's that when confronted with death, the first thing you want to do is figure out how to have a baby?
No, not like that. I'm saying that it's part of the overarching brand of not dying is the reproduction part. Basically, why we run from discomfort or why we're afraid to be vulnerable all like goes back to the fear of death, doesn't it?
Yes, but I guess I'm saying I think it's independent of the reproductive paradigm. We are afraid to let go and to cease to be in the way that's familiar to us. At every step of the game, every conversation we have is marked by that. Every passing year is marked by that. Every sneeze is, oh God, I'm going to die. I mean, you know, they even say, God bless you when you sneeze.
Yeah.
You're going to die. So anyhow, not to get too morbid about the whole thing, but in terms of comedy, which is, when you said people revere musicians and give them a wide swath, you know who musicians revere, right?
Comedians.
Isn't that true?
100%. Both wish they were each other. Like rock stars really wish they were funny. And then comedians are fantasizing about being a poster on the wall and the elevated stage and like the sustaining that one note for 3 minutes and people requesting the old stuff. Like, because comedians are like, oh, that's so great. You guys get to just play the same song for 30 years and people love it. And like, are you kidding? I hate this song. I don't want to play this song anymore. I can't get away. I can't do a single set where they don't request this song. So comedian, it's a magic trick. It's got to be new, fresh, always. And then musician, it's like, we don't want to hear your new stuff.
Well, and then isn't it true for a comedian that it has to be funny?
I used to think so, but...
I guess there have been some people who played with the edges of that this is not really that funny.
It does have to be funny and it's sustaining an energy level, whereas music it doesn't have to sustain like the intensity the whole time. It can kind of go in and out of intensity, right? And attention can even wander a little bit during a music set, whereas comedy there can be no portion during the hour that you'd want people talking amongst themselves at the table.
Right.
Maybe a little jab, maybe like, oh, you do that.
And why did you give up being a comedian?
No, not at all. I'm just less of my eggs are in that basket. And
I
don't think I've ever given up anything. I haven't given up music or comedy. It's just I'm doing fewer sets than I was doing 5 years ago. I haven't been uploading.
You still go up sometimes?
Yeah, and I want to record another hour this year. We'll see if I do it. Like I never do what I'm going to say, but there's a lot of things I tell myself I'm going to do and there simply is not room for all of them, and how it plays out is anybody's guess because it's subject to that version of me that day. Have you ever done this? I'm playing with this idea of, and I didn't invent it, but basically you're not the narrative of all your previous days. Like I act like I just quantum leaped into this version of me, not even today, like right now. Like I have memories and I have objects of like, oh, who was this person? Okay, interesting. How can we go from here? And not carrying the baggage of I have been this person for decades.
It's just That's what we mean by suddenly free from fixed mind.
There we go. Cool. I called it quantum leaped into this me, suddenly free from fixed mind. That's even better.
Yeah, and that's just way, you know, one particular teacher framed it. But there are many, many ways of saying that particularly in the tantric Buddhist tradition. It's like the transmission is that pointing out, they call it pointing to the nature of mind, pointing out instructions that there really is no continuity to the mind. It's not, that is a sort of another level of it, but actually the actual nature of the mind is just spontaneous awareness in this present moment. That's the actual nature of your mind.
Mm. This might be a jump, but do you think therefore we're not going to be able to replicate it with our little toys, with technology and AI? We'll only be able to come up with an impression of it and we'll never be able to do it because we're trying to make it a continuous boxed in, like we're making an artificial general intelligence. Wham. Or is it?
I've contemplated that because, you know, obviously we're going to have to deal with the fact that in so many other ways, it's going to be able to duplicate what we do and far surpass it fairly quickly. So this aspect of access to non-conceptual awareness would be as the sort of, and they say all sentient beings potentially have it. It's not just humans. It's the ground of the whole situation. People call it different things, but would a machine intelligence be able to have that experience and therefore become sentient? I think that would be, for me, that would define sentience. Not that it can think well, that it could not think.
Mm.
If you cannot think, then you're sentient, but stay aware. That's how I define sentience. Could it access that? You know, I'm watching a bunch of the sci-fi and some of the indie sci-fi stuff, and they're playing around these ideas. And I'm not sure would be my ultimate statement. I've been feeling a lot like we're biological machines. We're some kind of machine. You know, I see people, they're different, they're part, they need parts replacement. I had cataract surgery. Am I an organic being now? Because I have these lenses that are manufactured. I have mesh around my gut from a hernia operation.
Me too.
You had a hernia?
Yeah, had it 2016. Woke up to the election results. It was a surreal time because I go under anesthesia and then wake up and then it's like Trump declared winner. I'm like, oh, this is interesting.
Maybe you could take some more of that anesthesia before the next election and have a different outcome would be really cool.
Oh, but I would do it if it was not a hernia. That's not fun.
But you're already a hybrid. Teeth, you know, some of these are mechanical replacements, you know, glasses. So when you talked about the singularity, you know, at a very crude level, we're already into it because we're using manufactured goods to supplement our biological reality. But the singularity is saying, could they be the CEO, the core operating system? Could you replace your brain? That would be a perfect example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, or I guess I'm speaking more to the, you know, the felt presence of immediate experience, which it's impossible to know other than your own felt presence of immediate experience. That whole thing of like, I don't know if you're a real person. You could be, this could all be a simulation. It was all me. And it's perhaps all of that. Like we're all the God self, the infinite creator witnessing through the various that it is. And time is all one thing. And we're just witnessing it linear. And
yeah.
All that subjectively, but can a machine, like, can it be like, I am? Can the machine really feel that I am-ness? And I don't know. I guess there's no way to actually
know. So much of what we experience as I am-ness is a distortion. That the two questions you should separate out is, could a machine become confused with the I am, you know, delusional? Or could the machine become, you know, really, you're talking about some kind of enlightenment or have that kind of level of real knowledge and real deep wisdom. And I don't know. One part of me thinks it's happened already many times.
So? You mean like 20,000 years ago, or you mean
recently? A million years. I don't know. Time has a different meaning. But for example, in Buddhism, they say there's 1,000 Buddhas. And Shakyamuni Buddha was the fourth in the garland of Buddhas. And the fifth one is Maitreya, is supposed to come in like 300 years. But the sense of time is not conventional.
Huh.
We have a very conventional sense of time, but time might be more, you know, multidimensional than we allocate. So I'm not really freaked out by any of it. That's the truth. I'm not as worried.
That taps into your not nostalgia-ness. Yeah, you're not nostalgic, yeah. And you're not fearful of the future.
Bring it.
I like that. Yeah. I try to be that myself. And yeah. I think I naturally am for the most part. And I have to kind of pretend sometimes, because you can come off as a bad person if you're not worried. Yeah. It's like very moral to be worried of, like, God, I'm so worried about. And then you present all this evidence, because the alternative is like, well, you're not going to do anything about the evidence that the future is bad. Like, I'll help you right now because you're standing right in front of me. But
yeah. Well, look, what'll impress me more is if a machine learning system can outdo you with your artwork, outdo you with your, creative literature, your comedy. What would impress me more is if it could have as good a heart as you seem to have.
As I seem to have, not the actual one.
I don't want to presume.
As good as
I can't say what's actually true. I can just say what appears to be true to me. But you know, that would be like, can you imagine like a robot with AI taking care of a child? And would it be a good caretaker for a child? And you go, and it's making decisions to protect the child, and it's making decisions to educate and to nurture. That would be more interesting to me than if it could duplicate the sort of toxic masculine aspect of cognition, you know?
Good way of putting it. Yeah. But that is more useful and more impressive. And these are all separate things, whether it is a mirror of us as an experiencer of I am, whether it is impressive or whether it is good, because it can be impressive. Like, oh, that thing just shot 100,000 people in 2 seconds. That's impressive. I don't like that. I don't think it should be doing that, but I'd be lying if I say I was not impressed by that feat of destruction.
And horrified.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and there's no doubt it's going to be able to do that. No, in my mind, you know, that's clearly that's doable. So yeah. Can you take care of my, I'm going out for a walk. Could you take care of my child?
Yeah.
That would be like, okay, wow. Deep. We've reproduced the kind of mother lineage, you know, of nurturing, you know, and we all need that. I don't know anybody who doesn't need that more than they need to be a smartass, you know?
Yeah. Like the Dalai Lama quote of, do I have too many quotes? Doesn't matter. But the world does not need more successful people. It needs more kind people. And we're always searching for success. Or Victor Wooten said, his mother said, what does the world need with another good musician? Like, you might just be chasing, like, how can you be technically impressive as a musician? Uh-huh. But what does the world need with that? Like, what can you actually provide that the world needs?
The world needs to allow its heart to be broken and to recognize, you know, it's funny because the mother thing, I mean, I may not be popular for genderizing this, and I don't mean to necessarily genderize it beyond the physical, but the heart level. You know, we're all giving birth, and we're all taking care of this place and these people and our friends. And there's nothing more beautiful than that. Period. Over and out. I'm done.
Yeah, and I think it's still fun to talk with genders as energies. And I think even the people who are the most gender ideologue, people accept that and will say, like, I'm in my masculine right now. I'm in my feminine. Yeah. This feminine energy, masculine energy. Feminine
it's still cool to articulate that way.
I think so. I'm not Gen Alpha, but I could be wrong. Like, this clip could be played in 3 years and I'm like, just the worst. I can't believe he said that. But no, I don't think but I get the hesitation, like when there is touchiness around a certain topic and you don't want to go into is like, oh, can we still use gendered language when we're speaking about energies? Yeah. Like, I think you can if you're...
I'm very humble at this point about all that. I learned it a certain way. I learned a sort of cosmic in Tantric Buddhism. They do talk about feminine and masculine principles. It's a part of the duality of Tantra, you know, that you don't mush it all together. It's just all one thing. There is articulation of you know, the kind of polarity as being a dynamic thing. But I know that I'm on the way out, you know, so I'm cool with that actually. you know, I'm very curious, you know, too. Like, so when you said what you said, I know of this non-binary person, and I would like to have that talk about with that person about masculine and feminine at the energetic level. But I'd be a little concerned about not, you know, wanting to, you know, violate any kind of wisdom that has come about that is obsoleting my perspective.
Yeah.
I'd rather get out of the way, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you want to not have any last second things of...
like, oh God, you know.
Yeah, I saw Carlos Santana had a little moment where he was just in between songs saying like, a man is a man and a woman is a woman and what you do in the closet, that doesn't... or some version of like, what you do in the closet doesn't matter to me. And just the fact that he used the phrase like, what you do in the closet, implying like, stay in the closet with the stuff he got...
Yeah, no, it's easy.
A bashing easy. For that.
It's easy to miss the moment in you know. So I tend to use my ears more than my mouth in this particular area
good.
These days. Listen, what a treat! You know, one thing about the podcast is people are getting to meet each other, maybe, and talk and chat in a way, and other people get to listen in. But I'm really happy to have met you, and really appreciate
me too.
You know what you're doing and the work you're doing. And I think it's that thing of like, things get born out of these, you know, connections happen. And hopefully we keep in touch and we can keep posted about the evolution of all the things we're talking about.
Yeah. You want to come on my show too?
I'd be delighted to.
Let's do it.
Okay. You invite me. I'll be there. Simple
you got
as
it.
That. Okay.
This is the actual invitation, and then the scheduled invitation will be in the email.
Okay, wonderful. So thank you so much for joining us for this brief period of time. I'm sure more to come. That's usually what's been happening, is it's actually spontaneously spawned some interesting connections and that reap fruit, you know.
Cool.
So good luck with
it
what you're doing.
By.
I hope you make a lot more money if you want to.
Me too.
And also, you know, stay true to yourself, and good luck with everything that you're doing. So again, thank you so much.
Thank you. This went by really fast and is an absolute treat. So looking forward to talking to you again.
There you have it, folks. Episode number 51 of the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast on the Be Here Now Network. To conclude here, we would like to extend a huge heartfelt thank you to Ramin for joining us and taking the time to be in discussion with David, and for all of his amazing work. Thank you, Ramin. We also encourage everyone to head over to BeHereNowNetwork.com. If you enjoy podcasts of this nature discussing spiritual practice in our contemporary world, head over to BeHereNowNetwork.com to check out an ever-growing catalog of podcasts based around mindfulness and Eastern spirituality. Also, give us a like, subscribe, give us all the stars, leave a review, share on the socials, share with your friends. Help us get the word out about the podcast. We would appreciate it. And if you're still listening, well, you made it all the way to the end of the episode and the outro monologue. So again, we really appreciate everyone listening. We hope that you enjoy these episodes as much as we enjoy making them, and that they are beneficial to you in your life, and by extension, to all sentient beings. May you be safe, may you be healthy, may you be happy, and may you be at ease. All the best.